and welcome to the Product Science Podcast, where we're helping startup founders and product leaders build high-growth products, teams, and companies through real conversations with people who have tried it and aren't afraid to share lessons learned from their failures along the way. I'm your host, Holly Hester Riley, founder and CEO of H2R Product Science. This week on the Product Science Podcast, I'm excited to share a conversation with Babber. Babber and I worked together at Shutterstock, and I've been getting involved in what he's up to these days at the Portfolio School. So welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
I'm so glad to have you. So I'm excited because I feel like I've known you for a while, but I haven't really gone too deep into the stuff you did before I met you. So I'm excited to like get to know another part of your life.
Yeah, sure. So I'm a technologist by training, and by most of my experience, my sort of like recent foray into education and schools has got me out of technology, although I do stay in touch. I grew up in Pakistan, and came here to the U.S. to do my undergrad, which was in engineering. And my first job out of college was at Intel designing, Pentium 3 at that time. This was mid-90s, and we were trying to break the 300 megahertz speed limit, which makes me sound very ancient now. and so, from an experience perspective, I worked in hardware engineering, hardware product design. My second job once I left Intel was at Philips Semiconductors. And this is sort of late 90s where, digital was going to be the main way to design future products, from set-top boxes to digital cameras, digital TVs, digital music players, and all of that. And that's the group I joined back in 98. And, it was just a great experience, both from a chip design perspective, but fully looking into things like what does it mean to design a digital camera and digital TVs and things like that. And Philips was a great place to do a lot of that work because they certainly, it's one of the companies that has done a lot of innovation in different engineering products. Whether they stay sort of like top of consumers' mind and mind share, that can be debated, but certainly from an innovation perspective, they've been made. And then from there, decided to do my PhD, which was in quantum computing. And that brought me to the East Coast and was at Princeton for about 6 years, both doing my PhD work as well as got involved in a fellowship program, which was a 2-year program at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public Policy. Looking at how science and technology can inform public policy. And specifically, I actually looked at the nuclear proliferation issue. That was something that was very close to my heart because that's the time when sort of like Pakistan's nuclear program got a lot of news coverage because there was information that was leaked out to Iran and to North Korea through the agencies in Pakistan. And so it was sort of forefront in the news. And I decided to sort of jump into that area as well through this public policy program, which was great, actually. I think I looked at technology and science from a very different perspective in those 2 years.
That sounds really interesting. I want to know more about that one. How did you like learn about the program and get involved in it?
It was actually funny. It was pretty coincidental because I knew a friend of mine who was in that program, and we were just having coffee and discussing Pakistan's nuclear program, and him and I got into a really sort of like a healthy and passionate debate, I should say. And I, after the cup of coffee, he's like, why don't you apply to our program? We do a 2-year fellowship for engineering and science majors. Of course, my advisor at that time, my PhD advisor, wasn't too happy that I was going to be doing this part-time. Mm-hmm. Turns out he was from Iran. So he was like, you know what? I empathize.
Okay.
So that's how I got into it. And it was great because the center, which was science and technology in public policy within the Woodrow Wilson School, was all scientists and engineers working and had made a career out of it back from the 60s onwards. And so I learned a lot from those folks as well. And, you know, we met with people at the State Department, at the Department of Energy, which in fact, actually, Department of Energy is the department that controls the nuclear program in the U.S. It was a great experience. I loved it.
Wow. So what did you do your thesis on in quantum computing?
Oh, gosh. You want me to say this loud? I looked at, so it was a, you can say, a material science sort of aspect of quantum computing. We looked at, my thesis was on gallium arsenide P-type materials and their effectiveness in building quantum transistors. So that's what my thesis was. Yep.
Wow. So did you do a lot of work both in the lab and in the analysis using computers, or was it more computer theory calculations and such?
Yeah, I sort of have figured out over the years that I'm not the best math guy when it comes to engineering and science. So, mm-hmm. So to me, the practical aspect was more interesting. So I was in the lab, like, you know, we had like these fridges is what they're called, where you cool down your material to literally millikelvin scales, like, you know, like really very, very close to absolute zero, to study sort of the quantum effects of different things. And because just the noise levels of everything just dies down at that temperature. Yeah, so most of my thesis work was actually in the lab. And the funny thing is, it's like now you, in fact, actually see quantum computing, the past few years has actually come out of, academia and labs and gotten into places like Google. IBM has been doing it for a while, but, you know, Google, Microsoft, Intel, where a lot of very active work is going on, both on the hardware side as well as software side. And now actually there's a couple of startups that have been funded in this space as well, which is just exciting to see, very exciting to see that.
Yeah, that's so cool. I used to do lab work as well in chemical engineering. And I
I didn't know this about you.
Yeah, see, there you go. Different things. There's a part of me that misses it. I loved, I was not using fridges that tried to get close to absolute zero. But we did, you know, use vacuums and I did magnetic resonance imaging testing. We were creating... We were working on different materials that you can use to see the way things flow through complex chambers. And, I feel like there's parts of it that just still apply to what we do as entrepreneurs, because having gone through, you know, how do you design and set up and talk about experiments and share your results out and all of that in the rigorous academic setting, and then, you know, going and seeing the way people do it day to day in, you know, say Shutterstock, I feel like we bring a different perspective than people who haven't done it, in the science world.
That's a very good point, actually. And I hadn't thought about it that way, but you're absolutely right. You know, there's that rigor to the academic world, which at times is lacking, you know, in the industry. So,
yeah. So how did you get from there? I mean, wow, there's got to be many more steps to this journey. So what came next?
So what came next was I did a consulting. I shouldn't call it a consulting gig. It was a consulting firm called Exponent out of Stanford that started about 40 years ago as failure analysis firm. and sort of has become like now it's called Exponent. And they started just in California in Menlo Park, and now sort of have like, you know, their presence in about 19 cities in the U.S. And this is a technology and engineering consulting firm. And so I joined that right out of my PhD and worked on very interesting projects over there, from looking at IP litigation issues around technology patents, and working with some of the biggest firms, Fortune 5 firms, Fortune 10 firms now, doing some interesting work around, you know, radiation and its effect on human bodies and things like that, to designing. We actually had a small group which designed, very particular engineering products for the U.S. Army. And so we looked at, so I was part of that team as well for a little while, designing some, they needed immediate radar systems, detection systems in the theater. Mm-hmm. And I was part of that as well, which was a great experience. And from there, a good friend of mine who was my college buddy, he was coming out of a very successful education ed tech startup called Chegg. And he was looking to do sort of this next step in textbooks, which was to become sort of the Kindle for textbooks. So him and I started that company back in 2008. This is when iPhone had just come out about a year ago, and it was very evident that the touch interface and, you know, sort of tablet designs will be the future. So we looked at building a dual screen tablet for educational purposes, and then have the full-on software stack on it as well. So build sort of like the precursor to a dual screen precursor to iPad. Because iPad wasn't in the market yet. It was much bigger screen as well, because it was for education. Back then, cloud wasn't like a main sort of thrust in a lot of products. But our idea was to, in fact, actually have that piece as well for analytics and stuff around how kids are, students are using textbooks, where they're getting stuck, where they're breezing through, what are the important sort of topics, chapters in each textbook that we find through our data. And so we became sort of the Kindle for textbooks at that time. Which is what got me back into education. From there, decided to be completely entrenched in education.
Yes.
And started a school recently.
How many years in are you now?
We are now, it's been, 3 years now? Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is the end of our third year.
Yes. Yeah. I don't know if that's still recent. Recent comparatively, I suppose.
I guess so.
Yeah. So, tell us more. I obviously know quite a bit about the school, but tell us, for our listeners, how did you decide to start a school, and what is it about?
Yeah, so it's the idea. So what happened after my experience in ed tech, and both in the university space as well as K-12, We got acquired by Intel. So I was at Intel Education for about a year and a half, integrating our software product into sort of Intel's ecosystem. And there we did sort of like massive grant projects around deploying technology in schools. My sort of whole thesis coming out of that was that, you know, there is a emphasis on innovation in education, which is just through the lens of technology, you know. And to me, it was evident that it's not just that when we talk about schools and education and learning. A lot has changed in our world around us, and a lot is changing very fast around us in the next few decades as well. And we should look at schools and what learning and education means really from scratch. And the good news there was that there's a lot of thought leaders in education that were talking about similar things. So it wasn't like we had to sit down and figure out a lot of things that we needed to do. You know, to me, it was like, you know, a lot of the science had been figured out, but now it was an engineering problem of taking that science and implementing schools and how it would actually practically work and all of that stuff. So that was the reason I felt like, you know, it's important to start a school so that we can really show what we can do and, you know, what kind of real innovation we can do in schools if we were to start from scratch today. You know? So that was the impetus. That was the exciting part about starting it.
Yeah. It's, I'm sure some of our listeners have spent so much of their time in software and, you know, physical products, and probably not a lot in designing, you know, entire ecosystems like schools are.
Right.
And so I imagine, you know, it might not sound so clear how that all fits, but I love the way that you framed it as sort of the science of knowing what works and what doesn't work had been figured out, but the engineering of how do we apply it and make it come to life, you know, hadn't. Tell me more about sort of how you came to that thesis. Like, what kind of things did you see maybe back at the company that was No? Is that how it's pronounced?
That's right, No.
Okay. What kind of things did you see back at No and at Intel when they were doing these like large-scale implementations of new technology in the classroom?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. So what I started observing was that, you know, of course, the delivery of content through tablets, for example, is a great idea, right? Or to see how a technology can make certain aspects of teaching more efficient is, again, a great idea. And that has its benefits. But fundamentally, the learning model was still, or the teaching model was still the same. There's this sage on stage. Who's the teacher who comes in, who delivers a particular set of knowledge to students, and students are sort of considered this vessel where sort of more and more content needs to be poured into them. And after a while, they're supposed to be tested, and the test actually shows how much they've learned, and that's how you sort of progress over 13 years of your, you know, very important years of your life. And it was evident that there's a lot of sort of evidence around how that model is, which started sort of with, you know, correlates really well with the industrial age and the advent of industrial age, but which is a very outdated model of education now, you know. And whereas it was kind of needed that, you know, the students who come out of, say, schools in New York City versus the students who come out of schools in Ohio should all be learning the same thing because they're going into the same sort of job market, which requires a certain set of knowledge that they all need. That idea, that philosophy of schooling does not apply anymore. And so what we like to call it is that, you know, we've sort of moved out of the industrial age into the innovation age, you know, and that's where the sort of the skills of creativity, the social emotional sort of habits of kids, the you know, the idea of how they work in teams, how they persevere, those aspects which we now call, you know, within our school, enduring skills, you know, are so much more important. And the problem remains is like, how do you create the right kind of genuine experiences for the kids to be able to experience that and learn these skills in a school setting? You know, because in a lot of ways, schools are very sort of like artificially created environments, you know. And so to make them more authentic so that kids are able to learn these enduring skills in a much more authentic way is what a lot of thought leaders in education have been talking about. And for example, you know, the idea of like just having them sit in a classroom and listen to a lecture and then be tested is not applicable. But like, okay, if you've gained a certain piece of knowledge, if you've been exposed to it, how do you apply it? That's much more relevant now, you know, because content obviously is in our back pockets now, in our phones. So how do you apply it? What do you do with it? How do you show you can actually work with it and the other pieces of knowledge that you have? So how do you connect all of that and do something with it is way more important. So now the question becomes, how do you put a sort of school environment together, which includes the space design, the role of the teachers, role of students, the role of the administration? All of that should be sort of thought through in a sort of like ground up, from a ground up level, and figured out like, okay, you know, this is how the space should be designed. Do we need classrooms? Do we need, you know, separate areas for certain sort of specials that kids go to? Why isn't it all integrated? Why isn't it more open? You know, why aren't teachers and students co-learning rather than a teacher-student kind of atmosphere, you know? And so all of those things need to be looked at and figured out from a practical perspective. They're all great in theory and stuff, but how do you practically do it? And that's what we're doing day in and day out. And it's just been incredible to see how much progress we've made and, you know, what the kind of issues we face every day and how we're tackling those as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell me more. I'm thinking about what you were just saying with the classroom design and the spaces, and knowing that, you know, before we started recording, you and I were chatting about your new spaces opening, and there's, mm-hmm. you know, construction going on there. And I think you've told me that, you know, your school's just finished their third year, and I think you did some construction like every summer, right? So you must have started somewhere and iterated continuously in as much as you could, you know, in the confines of a real world. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about like, what did you try in the beginning and how, what did you learn from it? What did you have to throw out? What did you keep?
Yeah. So I think one of the things that we think about in our school is that, you know, this is, it's a changing world, and what kids have to be sort of trained in or be very comfortable with is like how many jobs they'll have. It's not going to be one or two jobs in their career, but it's going to be multiple different jobs. They'll have to sort of learn new things as they grow in their careers, and always need to be agile, you know. And we wanted to actually apply that to the culture of the school as well. I mean, if you look at schools, it's one of those verticals that actually sells you on tradition and not changing things, right? I mean, a school is considered an amazing school or best school, or, you know, where everybody wants to go is because they've been in existence for 100 years, for example, right? It's very hard to think that way about anything else we do, but for school, it's all about that, you know. So we really wanted to change how the culture of the school is and be able to make thoughtful, meaningful changes as the year progresses, as, you know, the number of grades that we increase, and always be thinking about, you know, are we doing it the best way, or is this, can we improve on things, you know? So that idea of, you know, iteration that we sort of like, you know, are constantly talking about in product design, right? That is something that I feel we should be also bringing into schools. Now, the timeline of that, what goes into it is very different in a school environment than say like a software product that you're building. You know, you can't change things on a dime in a school, but you at least have that, you know, that philosophy that, you know, we look at everything like, you know, our units go for about a few months every, every few months is when we finish our unit and go on to the next unit. Even after the unit is done, there is a big sort of time for reflection. and we try to understand, okay, what went well, what didn't go well. We teach that to the students, but we also sort of in the adult organization sit down and figure, talk about it so that we can in fact actually improve in even in the second unit that, of the year. Right. And that's the kind of sort of spirit that I want to maintain in the school as well. Like even as we grow, even as we go more than 10, 20, 30 years, right? When supposedly you're all set in terms of what your schools are about, but that sort of should be that culture of change, that culture of, you know, improving all the time should be there in that organization forever. And it's important. So, I mean, we've learned a lot. We've learned a lot about, you know, from our first year, how we designed the space. We had to change things for our second year. A good example that I like to give is that in the first year, we had less number of students, but also so we kept it a lot more open. But we realized that we do need quiet spaces within that open design. So how do you do that and bring that in without losing that spirit of openness in the school? So that's one example of how, you know, what we found we could sort of improve on from a space perspective.
Yeah. Sometimes the things we think, we think about sort of one side of the positive of something, but then we forget about the other side, right? So it's like, we're going to have open spaces. People will be able to collaborate. They won't feel like they're stuck in a room. But then on the other side, you know, sometimes it's like, well, where do you go when you want quiet?
Exactly. Exactly. And that's, it's a very important thing to actually keep that open mind, that, you know, you come in with something that you may be passionate about. And I'll speak for myself here that I was very passionate about like having open spaces in the school. But we realized that, yes, open spaces are nice to have, but there has to be a balance, you know. So you have to be open completely about, like, making those changes as well.
There must have been, I mean, and I think you've kind of expressed this, but as I'm thinking about how this maps to, you know, the day-to-day experiences, for those of us who are still working with software products more than whole ecosystems, I'm thinking about sort of that delicate balance between the agile and the decision making and the like iterating and improving, but also having the core guiding principles that people can come back to and have, you know, that frame around it to be like, okay, is this dynamic working for what we wanted?
Yep, exactly. And that's a balance there that you have to maintain. Like you can't change things too quickly. Especially in a school kind of setting. And but if you're changing it, you have to go to your core principles as well to understand, hey, this is why we believe we started this. What are the values there that we can't like just give up on, you know? And also, I think there's a, in that vein, one of the things that, you know, when you're looking at sort of making a, like, you know, you're looking at a really big product, like, you know, okay, we want to change the game for schools. You know, that's not a sort of a small idea. It's a big idea, right? And how do you tackle something that big and figure out how you're going to break it down and work on things in the that are most important in the beginning stages, and how you're going to wedge yourself into an already very big ecosystem and then be able to expand from there. I think that's, you know, as opposed to building sort of like products which may be, you know, improving on a couple of features or, you know, are sort of smaller in scope. If there are, you know, entrepreneurs, product designers who are thinking about sort of like, I hate using this word, but that's disrupting like certain industries, right? I mean, I think you have to always keep an eye on that big idea, but then be very sort of focused on, okay, how are you going to get into it? What are you going to do in your first few years? How are you going to then grow from there, you know? Those are important things too. And what are the things you're going to keep changing, keep iterating on, that'll actually take you there to that big idea or the big goal that you have in mind.
Yeah. Are there any sort of debates you had in the early days of portfolio school where maybe there was something that that you had to decide a lot around on that? Like, how are we going to wedge in here? How do we get this to a hold?
I mean, I think so. The big debates for us were things like, our big vision was that, yes, you know, we want to do something by building a school ourselves. And then we want to affect sort of education. Ultimately, the goal is to affect education in a sort of a much bigger way where we can partner with public schools or other private schools and stuff and really change the game for how education is thought of, like in schools and stuff, you know. But initially, we were like, okay, so what's our wedge? And is it our own school? If it is, then is it a private independent school? Where would we put that private independent school? If it's not a completely private independent school, is it a charter school? Or if it's not our school, is it like some sort of a collaboration with a public school? And we looked at all of those different options as to, okay, how are we going to start this idea? And when we looked at it, we felt like the most, the best way to sort of keep control of our vision is going to be an independent school, where we are not bound by, say, the public school system and the idea of, like, you know, showing results through testing and things like that. Charter schools also have that issue. They can be quite a lot more independent, but still have guidelines and rules to follow from the, from the state departments of education. And so we felt like to sort of own our destiny, we have to do it as an independent school. And once that is established, is working, we can then go from there and, you know, partner with other schools and other organizations to take our ideas to a much broader scope.
Yeah. And did you, I'm thinking about that kind of decision, right? It's like it has ramifications, lots of ramifications, because then you get set like that, you get started, and now you're in that system. And sure. I'm curious, you must have done, what kind of research did you do to get a sense of, you know, what those ramifications might be and what these options might lead to?
Yeah, I mean, I think, so we talked to quite a few people, we visited schools, independent schools in New York City, we talked to a lot of thought leaders in education who were either, say, for example, associated with making changes in public school systems, had been working with public schools or charter schools, or had started charter schools and, you know, were running successfully. And as we were talking to them, we were looking at, okay, you know, if we start an independent school, here are the things that we'll have to worry about, you know. And if we started a charter school, here are the things that will concern us the most, or if you're partnering if you're just an organization helping public schools, what does that look like and how much effect we can have and how quickly we can actually have that effect. And, on the pro side, yes, it was, it made sense to do an independent school because of the control we would have, you know. And then the flip side is then, that also means that when it comes to funding, when it comes to resources that you'll have, it'll be a very, it's a very sort of direct to consumer model at that point. And that has its challenges, especially like, you know, as you're building something like a school. So we would have to actually then make sure that those are things that we will understand, like, you know, how to tackle those and stuff. And we had certain ideas about it when we started, and as we stepped into it, you know, as we learned more, we believe, in fact, actually, our point of view of those ramifications has changed also.
Yeah. Sometimes we learn lessons on the go, right?
On the go. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Well, I'm also curious to share, a bit of your growth story, or portfolio school's growth story. I mean, so you're at the company, the school is about 3 years old, right?
Yeah.
And what is the journey looked like so far? You know, number of, how do you measure it? What are you looking at to know?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a few things that we have in mind. Like, you know, the growth, of course, is the growth of the students. So we started with just 7 students. We're going to about this year, we were 24 students, and now we're going to be about 32 students in our new space. So we go growing, thoughtfully and very in a measured way, you know. And the reason is because, especially in our early years, if we grow too fast, then the way we want to iterate and the way we want to make sure that we're being thoughtful about things won't be possible. You know, there are certain schools who have grown very quickly in their initial years, and it's the troubling part of that, or the thing that gets sort of out of control, is that then you're just more concerned about the organizational side of the school rather than the sort of pedagogical or teaching or learning side of schools. So that's one metric, but we've been very thoughtful about that metric, you know, because it's something that we want to, we obviously want to grow, but not as at the expense of the quality of the program. So the quality of the program is another thing that we keep an eye on, like, you know, how do we build our units, how learning takes place, how are we measuring that learning, and it's not just measuring by tests and things like that. There are other things that we put in place that are important. And when we do sort of efficacy studies as well, like, for example, we had one of the professors at the Teachers College at Columbia, his graduate students spent the whole last year with us, they were able to qualitatively show, and in some cases quantitatively show, that what we talk about in our philosophy of the school is in fact being implemented, you know. So those things are very important to us, and we measure those along with just the growth side of the school. And in terms of the growth, we obviously, the idea is not to just remain in a small private school in New York City, but to in fact have a network of schools. And that network of schools would hopefully one day be not just in New York or adjacent areas, but across the country and even internationally as well, you know. But in order to do that, the other side of what we have our eye on, the quality of the program, is extremely important. Once we have that right, you know, the growth mm-hmm. will come.
Exactly. You have to deliver on the outcomes that the product is all about before you can, you know, scale the people that are getting in.
Absolutely. Exactly.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that in the conversations and the writing that gets spread quickly from Silicon Valley and startup world, it gets lost more than I would like.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of just focus on growth for growth's sake, and the sort of, I almost want to call it success theater. But it's not long lasting success if it doesn't deliver those values, the outcomes that it's supposed to.
That's so true. I mean, I think it's a very important aspect of something that is troubling in Silicon Valley, and you know what's happening over there. In fact, actually, there is an example of a school system which was started in San Francisco by a tech entrepreneur, and their growth, the way they grew out of San Francisco into New York City, it was so fast that they couldn't sustain it. And then this year, they've actually shut down all of their schools and sort of pivoted into just a tech company. And to me, you know, when I used to look at that model, I used to always say that, look, you know, you cannot apply the same principles that we think through, you know, that we think about in, say, for example, software product design into these other areas. And I think you're absolutely right that even in software product design, I think we need to be mindful of things like rapid growth and, you know, viral growth of, like, you know, exponential kind of growth, and things like how soon it happens and why it happens and whether it's sustainable or not.
Yeah. They closed all of them. I remember when they closed the New York one, but they're all.
No, so they, this year, this just now, they've closed all of them.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I should be actually be, I think the correct way to say it is they've transferred the ownership to another school system.
Ah, okay.
Of the remaining ones.
Yes, got it. That's a nice way to say it. That's,
yeah.
Yes. I remember one person I had a private conversation with who had a startup that they sold. He said it was a fail sale. And I was like, oh, I'd never heard that term, but okay, that's a thing. Is
it? Fail sale, yeah. I've heard fire sale being used, but fail sale is, I think, a better one.
Yes, exactly. I was like, oh, that's a good story. Yeah. But sometimes we don't know about what's going on, what's really going on. So one of the things that I love about what you're doing that I love to talk a little bit more about, and also just in general, this season of my podcast, we're talking more about sort of policy and implications for the world at large and society and things. And I'm thinking about how the Portfolio School, it's not just like we use tech in the school, but it's also the school understands how tech is changing the world and what that means for the future and what that means for what people need to do.
Yeah.
And I think that is, I don't know. Do you think people are talking about that enough? I guess now maybe more than they were even 3 years ago, but.
Yeah. I think people are talking about that in sort of schools and like, okay, what's the future of work and, you know, how much technology is going to play a role into our lives and what does all of this mean. And one of the things that sort of is commonly then talked about is like, what will jobs look like? And, you know, some of the statistics that are, you know, that commonly thrown out are things like, you know, 65% to 80% of the jobs that our kids are going to have not been invented yet, for example. And that usually sort of scares people, you know, that, okay, oh my God, what does that mean? What does that mean for the education of my child? And what are they learning in schools? And are schools relevant and all that stuff? And the way we try to answer that is that, you know, I think what we need to do fundamentally when it comes to technology and the future is that, you know, kids need to be comfortable with how all of this technology works. What sort of the under the hood ways that AI works, for example, or blockchain works, for example, what is software? What does it mean to actually be designing hardware products and things like that? You know, and kids need to be sort of, I think all kids need to be exposed to it. Like we expose all kids to arts. We should be exposing all kids to how technology actually works. They now don't all need to be engineers. They don't all need to go into software programming and things like that, or, you know, tech product design. But they need to know how all of this works, because I think it's important that whatever they're going to be doing, they're going to be using this technology and they can't be afraid of it. They have to sort of be more like, okay, how can this kind of technology help me do my work better? How can I take this technology and do more things with it? And not just more things with it in their line of work, but I think there's going to be a lot of ethical questions that our future generation is going to be answering about this kind of the future technologies, right? And they can't come from a perspective of being fearful of these technologies because they don't understand it. You know, I think our view on all of this is that if they are comfortable with all of with these technologies, they'll in fact actually make better ethical decisions around it, and they'll actually be able to use it in a much better way in their work life and whatever line of work they do. So that's how we, you know, sort of try to answer that question. You know, it's not something to be fearful of. It's something to be actually embrace in a way where, you know, you understand the good side and the bad side and are able to make good decisions out of it. You know, and I think a lot of the things that we are seeing from you know, our technology hubs like Silicon Valley is that people who really understand technology are not worried about the ethical side of things, you know, and people who are worried about ethical side of things don't necessarily understand the technology piece that well. And I think that gap has to just be closed, you know, and that's sort of like, you know, that's how we perceive of like technology. So like in our schools, like kids will do a lot of hands-on work. For us, like, you know, the technology plays in like that they're on like some online learning platform, but that they actually, you know, can open a computer, understand what's inside, you know, they can build a computer on their own. They can use drills, soldering irons, you know, carpentry is a tool in their toolbox, you know, and it's something that they use to build on their ideas and show what they can do with all of this. That's a big part of what we want kids to spend time on, you know, and not just like, you know, these, not just opening a computer and stuff, but like, to me, it's like, all of this is like pencil and paintbrush that you use for, you know, that's a tool. And so is the rest of technology, right? And so, you know, this merging of arts and tech and humanities and technology is so important. And that's what we work on when it comes to the curriculum side.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're about out of time, so I'm going to wrap it up. Are there any sort of final things you want to share? You know, I think particularly for entrepreneurs or people who are trying to disrupt something that's been around for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, to me, it's a couple of things. Well, one we just talked about is like, you know, especially if there are entrepreneurs who are thinking about big ideas, like how do you wedge into the right place within that big idea? You know, I'd like to give the Tesla example that Tesla wanted to disrupt the whole auto industry, but they started with a very high-end sports car. And that's how they wanted to tackle the market. So, you know, you have to figure out what that place is where you're going to come in. Secondly, and like, you know, a lot of people talk about it, but I can't reiterate enough, is the team that you build. It's so important. The focus that you place on the bigger vision that you have, you know, you can kind of get lost into sort of small details day to day and how you're going to figure out the next 100 things that you're worried about. But, you know, if you have a big idea in your head, just from time to time, look at that as well.
Yes. sometimes you got to do that. Well, thank you so much. And, you know, congratulations on how much Portfolio School has done so far. I'm so pleased to see it. Thriving.
Yeah, we have to bring you in and show you the new space, and you know, hopefully we'll do more with you this year. And this was fantastic. Thank you for inviting me to this podcast.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for coming. It's going to be so fun to share all these things and see how our listeners are, you know, react and respond to everything we're sharing this season. So I'm super excited to share this one. Thanks, Bamber.
I'm looking forward to it as well.
Product Science Podcast is brought to you by H2R Product Science. We teach startup founders and product leaders how to use the product science method to discover the strongest product opportunities and lay the foundations for high-growth products, teams, and businesses. Learn more at h2rproductscience.com. Enjoying this episode? Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss next week's episode. I also encourage you to visit us at productsciencepodcast.com to sign up for more information and resources from me and our guests. If you love the show, a rating and review would be greatly appreciated. Thank you.